On a balmy April day, Mackenzie, Reagan, and Stephen, three discerning minds with a shared obsession for stories, whether bound in print or projected on celluloid, joined forces to create Owls of Palace, a production company dedicated to the fine art of analysis, banter, and occasional film-related existential crises. With real lit and shelf criticism under their wings, these three have explored the highs and lows of storytelling with an impeccable eye for detail and taste. Or so they'd like you to believe. But what of the forgotten cinematic oddities that lurk in the recesses of late-night streaming services? What of the lesser fare that once graced premium cable in the hazy hours of insomnia-fueled channel surfing? The direct-to-video gems you rented on a whim when the new releases wall at Blockbuster had failed you. Surely these deserve their day, or at least their midnight, in court. This is Parliament After Dark, the periodic special episodes where your nocturnal cinephile hosts take on the weird, the wild, and the questionably watchable films of the midnight movie canon. From cult classics to hidden gems, low-budget wonders to cinematic fever dreams, no film is too obscure or outrageous for our After Dark exploration. Each episode will journey into the heart of the late-night cinematic abyss, dissecting what makes these films enduring curiosities, or perhaps just enduring mysteries. So whether you're here for the nostalgia, the camp, or the unexpected gems buried in the rubble of cinematic chaos, you're in the right place. Dim the lights, settle in, and step into the shadows of the unconventional, the bizarre, and the utterly unforgettable. Now, the parliamentarians are seated. Let the session begin.
Welcome, everybody. How's it going, Mackenzie?
You know, it's going really great. I'm excited. I'm excited for this special episode.
Yeah, it's kind of strange, isn't it? We're sitting here in the studio, and it's not real lit.
It's not real lit, and you know, some random person just decided to walk in and join.
Yeah, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello. Hi, I'm the random person, Reagan. I'm super excited and honored to be joining today.
Yes, absolutely. Reagan has been our producer for every episode of Real Lit.
Yes, and she's such a wonderful addition. Every time we get together to talk, she brings in new light to all of our conversations. So I'm excited to hear her opinions today, especially.
Absolutely, because we made her watch a truly terrible film.
So welcome to the club.
Yeah. Yes, it was an enlightening experience, to say the least.
So the premise of this, we're not sure how far we're going to take it, but we have Real Lit, we have shelf criticism, and there are just some of those oddities that defy categorization. Mm-hmm. What we would sometimes call midnight movies or late night movies, because we are the Owls of Palace as our production company, hence the title of this, Parliament After Dark.
You have to play on all the words.
Yes.
You just have to.
We're masters of bad puns, aren't
we? In the job description, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So I am really excited about the first film that we have. So we're going to start this segment as a midnight spotlight, just kind of another play on words, you know, as a midnight movie to put a spotlight on it. And the first film in our inaugural dalliance is Zizek Road. This 2006 film stars Katherine Heigl, Tom Sizemore, Lee Grillo. You've either never heard of it or you know it by its infamy.
The lowest grossing domestic box office in history, this film took home a whopping $30. There are extenuating circumstances, of course, but still, this film will carry one of the most ignominious reputations in the history of celluloid.
And you heard that right. $30.
30 whole dollars.
Yeah, Stephen made me aware of this film. I was definitely shocked by the combination of actors with that financial income.
I just stumbled across an article that mentioned the lowest grossing film ever made, and I'm like, well, I got to find out what that is. And
absolutely.
Then I was like, I've got to watch this. My first thought was like, is this some kind of low budget student film that somehow miraculously made it into the rotation? But no, I mean, we're talking Katherine Heigl. Tom Sizemore used to be a pretty well-known actor as well, so.
I'm not going to lie, I thought a little less of Katherine Heigl after watching this movie.
That's right, you were a big Grey's Anatomy fan, aren't you?
Yes.
And I like Katherine Heigl as well. I thought she was personally the best part of this film.
I could not agree more.
I do.
Her acting chops are on display. She's quite the actor.
Even the different parts of her face that we saw.
We will get into that, I suppose. So I guess we should tell the story then. As we said, there are extenuating circumstances. We're working mostly off of an article from Entertainment Weekly by Rob Brunner called How Zizek Road Only Grossed $30. This was originally reported by a film site called Chud.com. Y'all don't get that reference, do you? cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers.
Oh, goodness.
Can't sound familiar.
There's horror movies back in the 80s, I suppose. But they first came across this idea. The reporter was just happening to look at IMDb and he saw the box office for this random film at $30 and thought, what? So essentially what happened is Leo Grillo is a fellow who came to LA in the 70s, I think, to try to make a name for himself acting. Didn't really work out, probably because he can't act. We'll talk about that. But he decided that he wanted to make a film with animals in it, with dogs particularly, because he's a big dog lover. And he gets in touch with John Penny, who's a, he's been in the business. He's done some, some assistant directing, a little bit of cinematography, I believe, some other stuff. And he's working on a screen treatment of this film. So the two kind of got together, and their basic idea was, we want to make this film, and we're going to release it overseas first. Maybe we'll release it domestically later, but overseas is where we really want to make our bank. Hopefully they would make enough to not only support the film that Grillo wanted to make, but also to get a little bit of a reputation. Hey, they made this low-budget film. They took it overseas. It sold. Maybe more producers would jump on. The problem with that, of course, is according to, and by the way, I'm not knocking unions. I'm 100% union. SAG, AFTRA, all y'all folks, you need the unions to protect you. We just saw the writer's strike, and I was 100% behind them. Sometimes with unions, strange rules get made. If you're a low-budget film, under $2 million, you are required by the actors' union to release it theatrically. So Penny just decided to go to one movie theater in Dallas and rent it out for a matinee showing for a week so that it was technically released. Six people saw it, $5 a piece.
And then two of them wanted to be refunded.
Not wanted to be. Actually, they worked on this film and one of them happened to be from Dallas. So they took, you know, they went to see the film that they worked on. And when Penny was doing another film, they wound up working with him again. And when they told him that story, he immediately refunded their money.
That was nice of him.
It was nice, but technically this thing only grossed $20.
Yeah. And I really like the interesting tidbit of the actual name, Zizek Road, right? Especially of the place and its interesting history. But for a fun fact of the day, Zizek is the last word in the English dictionary. So just had to be best for last, I guess.
And this was the last time I will ever see this movie.
Actually, we should mention this too. It will not be the last for me.
No.
Yeah, as you know, of course, through shelf criticism, I'm quite the DVD connoisseur. I swear we didn't plan this. If you listen to our episode teases for the upcoming shows on Real Lit, we've been talking about this for, what,
three months?
Yeah, tomorrow. We are recording this on November 25th. November 26th, the 4K Blu-ray Special Collector's Edition 2-disc of Zizek Road releases. Mine is already pre-ordered and is in the mail, so it will be in my mailbox tomorrow.
Perfect timing.
And I hate this film, I gotta say. It's awful. But I've got to get that second disc and watch these special features. I've got to know everything about this. If you're going to be this infamous, then I want to know everything there is to know about it. Yeah, we should say this too, just because I'm going to savage Leo Grillo quite a bit today. But he's a genuinely nice guy.
He's a man after my
own heart, because he actually has a very large animal rescue. He loves, it's not just dogs, but basically he realized that people were taking dogs and cats and just dropping them out in the, kind of this place where he lives in California, where it's kind of rural. And he takes those in, he takes care of them, but he also, it's like horses, rabbits, everything. He's got, I believe I read, the largest animal rescue in the entire world. So the name of the organization is Delta, which is Dedication and Everlasting Love to Animals Rescue. So nonprofits. Incidentally, also the film we just mentioned he wanted to make with animals was a film called Magic. I just have to read this description. It did get made in 2011. Magic, the dog, is an angel sent to heal a broken family. Brad is a lawyer doing the best he can do to raise his daughter Kayla without the wife he misses. Kayla is longing for her mother, who died 7 years before. Sarah is a medical research scientist who had an epiphany caused by Magic the dog. As Magic escapes the research lab where he is a subject, and he is pursued by Dr. Ortero and the laboratory's entire security force, he fulfills his angelic role as the catalyst that helps Brad, Kayla, and Sarah discover their love for each other. Did you follow any of that?
No.
I mean, there's a dog in it, so...
There's a dog, and he may or may not be an angel, but he's being experimented on.
There's a medical researcher.
Who knows? I will say, if you notice that in the film, when his character, Grant, comes across the dog in the trailer park, meth lab, wherever he is. You know, at first you think he's going to, like, hit him with that shovel because the dog's barking. And he's like, oh, he's a good boy. And he starts petting him. And like, okay, you're the villain, but you're going to pet the dog instead of smack it.
That is a nice nod.
It is a nice nod. And Did either of you, I bet neither one of you watched all the way through the credits.
No.
You know, you should do that. I always try to because every name on there has a mama and that mama's proud of them, right? But still, I always do, just for whatever reason. You know how they have those sometimes, the no animals were harmed in the making of this film? This one reads, and I quote, "The animals in this film enjoyed performing for you and were treated like movie stars."
Aww. I love that.
Yeah, it's really hard to hate this guy and because of knowing all of that, because we're all animal lovers.
Yeah.
Right. So that being said, why don't we hate on it? Because this is not a good film.
Yeah, we're going to move into what we call Midnight Musings, and this is where we all give kind of a quick assessment of our takes on the film, just briefly. You know, I'm going to be honest. I liked it more than Zombie Strippers.
I didn't. And I hated Zombie Strippers.
I did.
At least that tried to be philosophical.
I mean, it wasn't a great film by any means, but it's not the worst thing I've ever watched. I also love the music at the beginning and end. I know that Steven has feelings about that. I thought it was fun.
I felt like it was a scary movie at the beginning with the music. Very
honest. I didn't think horror.
You did not?
I thought very like...
I thought it was like one of those Cinemax After Dark films or something. Mm. I'm like, what have I stumbled into here?
Fair.
I mean, the effects are poor. The lighting is funny at times. The light on the RV shined just like this giant star, and then it just disappeared, and there was this like dimly lit RV. And so just little things like that that were so juxtaposed that it was cringy, kind of, that got to me throughout the movie.
I don't know if y'all will understand this reference, but it made me feel like I was watching a Tim Robinson sketch.
No, I totally don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, other than that, to say something more universal, I will give it credit for making me truly jump out of my skin. The moment where Joey appears during their little rendezvous scene in the car, that genuinely scared me. And I don't know if the tone of the music just got me into a very scary headspace. And I mean, obviously there were some moments where they were trying to be kind of thriller shock, but it got me, so...
Do you think it was a scary film overall?
No.
What'd you think?
No.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm just a baby.
No, yeah, the things that were supposed to be scary, the weapons, the blood, the effects, all of it was very cringy. That's the word that just keeps coming to mind because every time I saw it, I was like, no. Blend it in a little bit more. I don't even know if they were real knives, honestly. They looked very play-like, so the realism just wasn't.
The blood
was
very orange, wasn't it?
And she was not 18. There's nothing you can say.
She's 26 when this was shot.
Yes, but she was supposed to be an 18-year-old, and she just did not sell an 18-year-old to me.
That's what I agree.
So I actually liked the setting a lot and the overall plot. I liked the middle of nowhere. I liked the idea of the unknown. I like the idea of this female villainess being supernatural or not supernatural. I really like that kind of confusion. And the best part to me out of the entire movie was the opening car ride scene where it's really just dialogue and foreshadowing in its ambiguity. And you could tell that it was low budget, but when they were just talking with each other in the car, I was like, okay, I can get through this plot development. I like where this is going. These characters are complex.
She slurps, though. That ring pop, or whatever you call it,
And those are so inconvenient to eat. I was like, why are you eating that out of all the things?
I saw that as being very suggestive.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But it was just obnoxious, which I think was kind of the point.
Yeah, she was annoying.
To me, the problem is their complexity stopped there. I mean, there was no more character development or growth, really. After that, the dialogue fell short. It got repetitive. But the opening car scene, I really did enjoy.
Fair.
Grillo was a very flat character, in my opinion. He had every opportunity to not be that way, but it was the delivery of his lines and the way he engaged in the scenes that just did not do it for me.
Yeah, and again, if you look at his IMDb page, there's like a couple of credits from like 1977, 1978, and then there's this, 2006. There's probably a reason you couldn't find work, buddy.
That's kind of low.
But you saved dogs, so I love you.
Mm-hmm. And then in the opening car scene, you know, they get to Zizek Road, and it's nighttime. And in the car, everything's pretty clear. But then the nighttime is just so dark when they get out of the car.
And I do wonder if part of that is because, did you watch it on YouTube?
Yes.
I watched it on Internet Movie Archive. Either way, it's really low resolution. It may be a little bit better when you get into a high resolution.
It reminded me of the Game of Thrones scene, the infamous battle in the dark where you could not see what was going on. You just saw like glimpses here and there. I just remember Twitter was in an uproar at how bad like it was.
Maybe it was. There's no excuse for that to be poorly lit.
I know, exactly.
Low budget film, sure. And it may be poorly lit, or they may have actually gone in and, you know, redone it and recolored some of that as well. I don't know. We'll find out tomorrow. You want to come in and have another watch party?
You'll need to let us know.
You're like, no, no. Nothing you can do. No amount of popcorn is going to bribe you to come watch that again, huh? Well, you know, you and I, Mackenzie, get along really well. Mm-hmm. Even on Real Lit. We've disagreed a couple of times.
Yeah.
But not very often. Reagan, we've not had a chance to argue. But what better time to actually bring in some debate, or as we like to call it, parliamentary debate. Because, again, bad puns will abound. So, Mackenzie, you had a take that I did disagree with.
On the lighting?
Yes.
So, it took me a while to try and comprehend this lighting in the desert, specifically when he's talking with Joey. And when he's talking to Marissa, it's very filmy, dim. Then when he's talking to Joey, it's very bright, vibrant, almost yellow-toned. And I was like, why is this filter switching so dramatically so often? It was kind of hard for my eyes just to understand. And I thought, well, maybe this is signifying differences in perception and reality. I don't know, but it was hard to watch.
That's absolutely it. So the times when he's hallucinating, imagining Joey, to use the technical term, we have a high-key saturated color grading. So it's very bright, and you'll see the colors pop, like the green in that truck, you know, when they're in the trailer park. And then when it's reality, when we're more focused on Marissa, it basically desaturates that color, pulls it back out. And I guess that kind of represents fantasy world, the bright contrast of colors versus the lack thereof. I think it's a brilliant move. I thought it was very well colored. That's just me.
I really enjoy the concept. I think just the low budgeting of it made it hard for me to see.
Like, are you saying the distinction was not as clear to you? Like, you noticed it, but the execution of it was not.
It's almost like it was too obvious. Like, and the cuts from scene to scene were so abrupt, I guess you could say. Like, now I feel like we would have a little bit of a pan, a little bit of a whoosh, like something to segue the changing color. But for this, it was just like camera scene one, then it shifts to camera scene two, and they're completely different colors multiple times.
I liked it. Agree to disagree on that one.
Fair enough.
More hot takes?
I actually did not think she acted out the snake scene very well. It was just very loud.
Let's talk about that snake scene.
I don't like it.
Well, I mean, animal attack, so obviously I'm immediately drawn to that. Did it really happen? Because that's part of the evidence he's building in his head, that she's recuperated so quickly from the snake bite she has to be a succubus. Or I don't think they ever say succubus, do they? But
that's
totally a succubus.
Snake makes sense. You know, snake symbolizing evil and seduction, and I get it, why they chose the snake.
And they foreshadowed it earlier, talking about diamondbacks were in that area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but first of all, it's in the car, right? It's like in the glove box or something.
Hey, I've heard of them sneaking up through your toilets.
Yeah, so. I don't know how accurate that actually is. It just makes me wonder if perhaps it wasn't a diamondback. Maybe it was just another kind of snake. Wasn't that venomous. I mean, she passes out, but that could have just been from fright and shock, right?
Well, I was confused because I thought he said she died for like a period of time, which, I mean, obviously this goes back to him being a little unreliable, but...
Right. He thought she died, right? Or I don't remember how it was phrased. I probably at that point was just begging for mercy. Lord, please let this movie go on quicker. I mean, rattlesnake bites are not always fatal, and they talk about how maybe it bit something else and didn't have all the venom that it normally would have had.
There's your logic.
That was interesting.
Right there.
That was really interesting to me. I was like, I've never heard that said before.
No, adult rattlers won't inject as much venom as, say, the babies who don't quite know how to control it. They'll save their venom for the prey, you know, when they're defending themselves. Mm. Maybe it was that. Why not just say it wasn't really a rattlesnake? It was a non-venomous snake that bit her. I don't know. That was a weird scene.
That's what I'm saying is, like, they go through links to explain things like that seem very subtle, and then we don't get a lot of explanation later for things that are like, okay, I actually do want to know about this part. Don't really care that much about the snake part, but we're going to explain the snake part a little bit more.
Well, you should. It's an animal attack.
I guess.
That's me. I'm a little more interested in that than others. I know. So what do we want to argue over?
I don't know if this is an argument, but I like the ending. I don't think it was done well, but I like the overall concept of the ending where we don't really know if he was truly going crazy or not. I like ambiguity. I like that the guilt overtook him in a sense to where he was in so much turmoil. But when he gets hit by the truck and we see him again, he is so perfectly okay other than one little line dripping out of his mouth. And I'm like, that makes no physical sense at all. It totally ruins the whole idea of the ending for me because I saw him and I was like, that man can stand up.
It's low budget. That's why you can't have the mangled body. Did we? I mean, is it ambiguous? I took it as like, yeah, he totally lost his mind.
He did. But I mean, just the inner part of me and like the American Gothic critic in me really wants there to be that minute possibility that she is a succubus.
Wouldn't that be great if she like just laughed evilly or morphed the way she did right
exactly.
at the very end? That would be so cool.
Exactly.
But did have a little bit of that evil character come out in the cave, right? She was like, you've been talking to Joey, haven't you? So it does seem like she's kind of the evil.
Yeah, but he's imagining that, right?
I don't know. I think that was real.
I questioned that one. I question who she is because of the narrative perception I'm getting of her through the main narrator.
What was the color saturation like there?
I think it was dark.
Ooh. I think it was dark because of the cave, but I think the actual colors were brighter.
That's how
dare we look it up.
Dare we look it up. That's a good point.
But Joey was nowhere to be found in that scene. Are we only going off of color, or are we going off of scenes where Joey is present?
That's fair, because Joey's not there. See, it shouldn't be this hard to figure this stuff out. Don't want to talk about something else while I'm looking.
So,
continue fighting.
Did she ever even have a tattoo?
I don't think so. I feel like that was a moment where he was victimizing her to justify himself.
It was a pretty ugly tattoo. For being honest.
Yeah, it was definitely doodled on with kind of markers. And it was only just for me. I also thought it was fake because, you know, I hope she wasn't in an abusive relationship. And if she was, though, there would be more signs of abuse, I feel like, than that single mark. So I feel like that contributed to his hallucination of it.
All right, so here is the scene. I just pulled it up. It's hard to tell because it's in the cave.
I don't think that's Brock.
It doesn't look like the high saturation, though, does it? There it does.
Yeah.
But he's outside of the cave now. I tell you what, I'm going to have to get my copy and watch it in high def and see what happens. That is interesting, and maybe it's deliberately ambiguous for that reason, too. Maybe Penny's a genius, and we're just not picking up on it. I think it's brilliantly directed. Way overuse of the shaky cam. That gets a little old. Otherwise, I mean, there's some wonderful camera angles and camera movement in this thing.
I think I'm so used to The Office and what we do in the shadows to where I am so used to the shaky camera now.
No, yeah, we'll definitely debate on that because I'm just, y'all stop. Uh-huh. Shaky cam, just, it's too much. You're killing me.
I do see what you're saying, that more shows and media are coming out with shaky cam
scenes.
It's
like a mockumentary.
Yeah, that we almost become immune to the overuse of it.
Not me. I take Dramamine half the time when I watch a film.
Let's move to Owl's Talons.
I've already been a little vicious, but I want to hear Mackenzie be vicious. What do you want to rip apart in this film?
So Owl's Talons is where we do rip our talons into a certain aspect or another. I truly did try to find elements of this film that are effective and that I liked. I like some of the dialogue and music. I like the setting, and I really like the overall plot. But the flashback scenes of the hotel room, especially the first one, is just really, really hard for me to watch. The above two shot on the bed is just not effective, and the lighting is very poor. The colors in the room are great, but the lighting is very poor. The entire scene is just very, like, childish home movie to me, and the comforter with all the little hearts. And I was just like, no.
What kind of motel is this?
It looks like a child's room, right? And that was disturbing to me. I just didn't like how it was set up. I didn't like how it was shot.
Well, did you notice there's stuffed animals on the headboard and stuff too? And I was just like, is this a hotel or is it her apartment? I mean,
I'll be honest. I genuinely thought it was her place.
I did too. Just a really crappy apartment.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's 18, air quote. And
or is she? I mean, right. We never get that answer.
Right. So, I mean, she could be. This girl is not listening to this podcast, I'm sure. But I knew a friend in high school who would watch Disney Channel, who had all the stuffed animals, who had the hard bedspread, and we were 17, 18 years old. So maybe they're just thinking that that could be a feasible thing for an 18-year-old girl at this time. I don't buy it.
I hear her referred to as a Lolita type in a lot of criticism, and maybe it's that. Maybe they're just trying to push that robbing of the cradle aspect of it.
Maybe, but she doesn't give off that persona at all in her actions. I also feel like there was maybe a little too much focus on her promiscuity in some ways, more so than we needed, is what I mean. So the entirety of the scene in the hotel room, I just really did not like because of where the focus was a lot of the times. It's just all the elements working together. I felt icky watching it. And like she's super undressed for a super long time. And I just felt like it wasn't necessary.
That's another way we differentiate for part of it, right? Is she's wearing like a negligee or something. And then suddenly she's wearing like a tank top and jeans.
Right.
And I get that, like, it's probably part of his hallucination or something, but still, it's weird. Because even with the switching of the saturation and the color, once she gets stabbed in the leg, right, she just wears jeans the rest of that time. Mm-hmm. So weird. Almost like it wasn't well planned. Anything you want to rip into, Reagan?
I would say that I was honestly sitting here thinking, how could we make this sound more intelligent and give it more credit than it may deserve? What if, just hear me out, what if it was supposed to be this shift from the male gaze into the female gaze? And we see her being more of this developed character by the end, and she's holding more of this power at the end. But throughout the majority of the film, she is viewed that promiscuous way, she's undressed, she looks kind of the dumb blonde stereotype. But then toward the end, I don't really feel like she portrays this persona anymore.
That's fair.
She definitely changes, for sure.
And she's smart the way she says, you know, give the gun to Joey, let him shoot me.
Right.
And he's really there.
I would never have thought of that, I'm sure.
And we were talking about, before we started recording, how the heck she knows he's talking to Joey of all people. But still, to figure that out and to make that move, that was a clever move.
Mm-hmm. It seems like she gets into his psyche a little bit.
Yeah. Starts messing with his head.
And she ends up having more power than Joey, who is in his psyche.
It's a good read, Reagan. You got me contemplating.
The guy who's credited as meth maker. I never got that was a meth lab until I saw that. But, no. I mean, it makes sense. He also just terrible, terrible actor. Just the way he comes, look, with that gun, the way he's got that grimace on his face, and then dude just clocks him with a shovel, and he's like, oh, help me. I don't know. It's just such uneven characterization there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one thing that bothered me, why was there just a convenient cave located in the middle of nowhere?
It was a mine.
Oh, it was a mine.
Yeah.
Even still, you know, he goes to look for Joey, and he's in the cave. Whoa, that's so shocking.
It is convenient.
You know, like, it's kind of like, come on.
I even considered this RV, like the meth house, if it was some sort of hallucinogenic oasis of some sort. Like, did he hallucinate this whole narrative plot to try and come to terms with his guilt? Like, is this his guilt trip? And then they use props in it and certain things, but I'm like, you know, that can of dust or whatever it is that she throws could just be sand, but he sees it as,
That's a fair point.
That's true.
I don't know.
Look, I mean, I think he probably actually does clock the meth man on the head, but all the other stuff could be something he imagined. I mean, that clothesline was dangerous. All it takes is a tug of a clothesline and she gets away.
That scene was hard for me to watch. That was a hard scene for me.
You know, those kind of scenes can work really well. You know, hiding and reappearing in different places and the wind blowing it in the shadows, but it did not work well here.
Well, like in an example of where it did work extremely well was I Know What You Did Last Summer with the tires in the alley. That was spectacular.
Absolutely.
But this clothesline scene, just...
Yeah, not good.
Not good. Not great.
So the next segments will probably make more sense in some of the other films we do. You know, there's always, you're watching one of those bad B movies from the 80s or something, and you go, oh my gosh, is that, you know, it's somebody who became famous at some point. This one, yeah, Katherine Heigl, we should probably mention, had been cast and was it about to start filming or had already been filming Grey's Anatomy? It was pre-Grey's Anatomy, so nobody knew her as Izzy at this point. But even one day, she couldn't shoot because they were doing photo promotional stuff for Grey's Anatomy. So it's pre-Grey's for Katherine Heigl. She wouldn't have been as known. As a matter of fact, that was one of the reasons Grillo and Penny said they were banking on her star power. Mm-hmm. They were assuming this was going to be a big hit and she was going to become famous. And then Tom Sizemore, of course, has his share of issues with substance abuse and the law. So that infamy, if nothing else, he's a pretty well-known actor, but the infamy, if nothing else, might carry it as well. I mean, they were right about Katherine Heigl, at least.
Yeah, I like Katherine Heigl as an actress. And while her character is a bit cheesy here in this film, I feel like she does a good job.
With what she's given, absolutely.
Yeah.
Except for when she gets bit by the snake.
Except for that.
Yeah, it was a bit over the top.
Even the greatest have some overacting at some points, I suppose.
And then similarly, going into Most Hated Character, coming in from Real Lit.
That's right. We were talking about these segments, and I'm like, well, I know we're going to have to bring Most Hated Character because that's Mackenzie's favorite segment.
I love characterization. I love to hate a character. I love a good villain. And in this one, it really wasn't a contest for me. We have so few characters, but it was Grant. He gets to me a lot. One, with his indecisiveness, right, as a person. He can't decide what to do at any point in time. But also just the way, like, he is so okay with killing someone. But he acts like he's not in his words, but all of his actions, he's so okay. He's not freaking out. He's like, we gotta kill Joey. Slams a hand in the trunk, that's just rude. You know, and then he is okay with killing her, and it's interesting because he's struggling with this guilt the whole time, but he seems okay with his evil actions as well. I don't know.
I think it is uneven again because, I mean, there's that moment where he's got Joey in the mine and he rears back to hit him with a shovel or whatever and he, like, freezes. He can't mm-hmm. do it. So he has those hesitations, but then at the very beginning he's like, yeah, they're talking about doing their taxes. Right. Now she needs to report her income so she can retire and there's supposed to be a dead man in the trunk they're going to bury in the desert. That's awfully mm-hmm. casual. Mm-hmm. I agree. It's got to be Grant, right? I know the blow to the head caused most of him... What caused him to be the aggressor, I suppose. I think, is that what the film suggests? He gets hit in the head with a wine bottle by Joey. But he just annoys me all the way around. And also, he's the worst actor ever.
Oh. Yeah, Grant, shocker. And I think that, yeah, it's some pretty bad acting. And I have not seen this bad of acting in quite a while.
You didn't watch Zombie Strippers with us.
No, I did not. No. I have to go back and look at that now. But I would say that Grant played too big of a role to then fall this flat on his face. And I had a really hard time believing that the hit to the head caused him to be this way. Especially when Heigl's character is saying, you're the one that bashed the window and you did all these things. I still couldn't make that connection as to his motive for that. So
I have a bit more of a theory. I think partially it's the blow to the head, but also the guilt mm-hmm. for cheating on his wife. Because, I mean, you get the sense this is the first time he's done it. Maybe his wife's a little overbearing. You know, she says, like, you know what Brenda's like. But I do think he's so worried about losing his daughter, right? I think some of that, because if you say, well, I was seduced by a succubus, then who could fault you?
Right.
You got to forgive your husband if that happened, because it's
sure.
magic, right?
Absolutely.
I see it as definitely a big lotus trope. Drink of the lotus and you'll be enraptured and there's nothing you can do about it to try and get out of the guilt that you've made the decision.
Honestly, I think you're changing my mind a little bit because I think the clue of him petting the dog and having this almost nice guy depiction of himself, that he doesn't want to be the way he is, but yet he is doing all of these crazy things that just seem in conflict to, I guess, how he wants to be. I don't know. I think what just makes it fall apart for me is his hesitation, is his casualness, because if we had a little bit more emotion from him, then I would be sold on the guilt aspect.
But that would require acting.
That would require acting, exactly. So now it is time for our WTF moment.
Yet another imported from Real Lit.
What can I say? They do things well.
Pretty sharp people there. I hear they got a good producer, too.
Yeah, I've heard. We should use her.
Who wants to start?
Okay, for me, this is definitely when she throws chalk, or Reagan was probably right, the baby powder or whatever.
Meth.
Yeah, whatever she throws.
We don't know what meth looks like. We're such goody two-shoes.
Yeah, or maybe that's a good thing. I was like, what is that?
Oh, we're like, that's a bad thing.
Maybe
we don't know what meth looks like.
Asbestos. Who knows?
And I mean, she literally directly throws this substance at his chest, not at his eyes at all. And then he starts screaming about his eyes.
It gets on his
chin. Yes, it's so much on his chin. I'm not a director, so I don't know. You know, I'm not trying to pretend like I can make that decision. I just feel like they could have reshot that scene to make it a little bit more connecting to what they wanted to show versus what actually happened physically.
It's low budget. They couldn't afford more meth.
Oh, no.
You know, for me, and I'm kind of with you here, I'm generally imperturbable when it comes to horror films. The jump scare that got me, though, is the first time we see Marissa's face just kind of like melt down, and it's not even the face. It's that the musical stinger that hits you at the same time. And it's just cranked up. It's so lazy to get a jump scare in like that. But I did not know what to expect out of this film. I didn't know anything about it. So I didn't know if it was horror or was it not. At that point, I was expecting the jump scares. So it didn't get me. But you got me on that first one, Penny. I'll give you that one.
Also, when Joey is attempting to toss the knife, he's like throwing it to himself. When he's trying to convince Grant to kill her. And he is acting like he's like this super cool professional knife thrower. And it's so not. And I just wanted to cringe so hard in that moment. I was like, stop, please doing this to yourself. Because he was just like tossing it up violently and then just grabbing it by the hilt and almost the blade very violently. It was very strange.
And when he's literally giving Joey's dialogue too. Let me see. Like when Marissa sees him, so he'll say something and he'll turn and walk to the other side and turn back. It's exactly, we had the actors from London a couple of weeks ago, right? And sometimes they'll play the same character on screen. They do this and they do it beautifully to comedic effect. This, as far as I know, this wasn't supposed to be a comedy though. That was so funny to me at the end when they're standing on the side of the road and he'll say something and then he'll walk back over to the other side. Just stop.
I feel like the entire film was a WTF moment for me.
I agreed. I was afraid that might be our WTF moment, just the film. Well, we have the Owl's Perch next. And this is a spot where, when we're watching some of these less than stellar films, perhaps, we find some moment just out of the blue that maybe makes a revelation or something well done, something intelligent, something we can actually talk about and get a little depth with. I don't know. Do we have a place to perch on this one?
I mean, I really do love this plot arc idea with the uncertainty and hallucinations. We don't really know what reality is at the end of it, and I like that kind of ambiguity, like mentioned earlier. They did well in leaving the viewer uncertain. However, I do think that his guilt is what spiraled this entire chain of events, or the hallucinations. I feel like we're almost reading our perch into it.
That may be.
And
I agree with that uncertainty as well. I like that fact. But again, I think it's just because nobody knows what to think when they watch this film. I mean, I'd never seen a trailer or a clip from it. I didn't know if it was horror. Was it thriller? Was it action? Was it, hell, it could be romance. I don't know. But I didn't know what to expect. And therefore, I think you really are confused. Is she an actual succubus? Is this just something going on in his damaged mind? So I thought that was effective, but it's more along the fact that, like, this never got a trailer and we all kind of knew what was going on or what to expect out of the genre more than anything else. So don't give it too much credit.
I try.
Don't give it too much credit. I was over here thinking he was the modern-day Hamlet.
Do you see any redeeming qualities or any?
You know, I will say this film had an unfair advantage, or a disadvantage, rather, because I approached my movie-watching experience knowing it was bad. And I think that was unfair to this film. I think that I should have gone in without knowing anything to then be able to say something that was not biased today. That's why I'm trying to say he's the modern day Hamlet, because we see the indecision, we see the hesitancy, the murder, some parallels going on
here. Something like a ghost.
Something like a ghost.
You know, I actually, this is kind of random, but there was a trivia question yesterday on which character is the most, like, reused or reimagined ever. Hamlet was an option, and that was my guess, because I was like, Hamlet is Simba in The Lion King, you know. Hamlet just fits so many different kind of archetypes, in a way, but the answer was Dracula, just putting that out there.
No, I could see that, too.
Yeah, so kind of random tidbit, but going off Hamlet, like, I see how you can see Hamlet in so many different characters.
I will concede Katherine Heigl's performance is very well done.
Mm-hmm.
The woman can act. Tom Sizemore wowed me. Aside from that, I don't know. I just don't know what else I can positively say. And I mean, y'all listen to Shelf Criticism. I try to find a positive to say about everything. And I have here the direction, the acting. But as far as a perch, something where you can go, hey, let's do a close read, like our segment on Real Lit, or let's talk about something intelligent. You pulled the male gaze into it, which I'm impressed by, but I got nothing. It's a film.
So should you give a hoot?
Yes, what we are going to do, we have to rank this thing, right? Have to give our honest opinions here. So we are going to give a parliamentary decree. How many gavels? So since we, I'm assuming we'll be doing this again
mm-hmm.
at some point, we will give the idea of the gavels here. So one gavel is outvoted. Leave it to the archives. Two gavels is a split decision. Approach with caution. Three gavels, a clear majority, worth considering. Four gavels, unanimously enjoyable. And five gavels, an Owls of Palace approved masterpiece. Spoiler alert, this one's not getting five from any of us.
I gave this film two gavels, split decision approach with caution. Because, for one, it's not the worst film I've ever seen. But also, it's the lowest grossing film of all time. You gotta watch it. I mean, just to watch it and see.
Just to say you did.
Yeah, just to say you did. You know, so that's why I gave it a two instead of a one.
I had one gavel, and as I was waiting on you two to get here, I watched it again and paid a little bit closer attention to it. And that's when I saw some of the directorial flourishes. Again, was reminded of just how good Heigl is in this. That bumped it up. I'm going to give it two. If Gorilla were any worse, that would just knock it right back down to one. But
I will say, so I also gave it two gavels. And Gorilla's performance piqued my interest in the fact that it was so bad, but it was also entertaining. So Heigl still made me think of Izzy a little bit toward the end, especially when we kind of removed that dumb blonde persona at the end. So I enjoyed that. And overall, I was engaged the whole film, and I had questions, and I was entertained. So that's all you can ask for to get two gavels.
You're right. Well said.
Well, there you go. You have now excoriated and slightly praised the lowest grossing domestic box office of all time. And if you are so inclined, perhaps you'll go out tomorrow and buy the 4K edition.
Oh, goodness.
You can use our discount code.
Shout out.
No, Owls of Palace Productions are not monetized yet, anyway.
But then if you know, you're passing by Isaac Road one time.
I do want to go.
You take
pictures? I've done some film tourism, seen the house, not exactly the house, but the place where Scream was filmed, some of those places. We've been to see the birds, you know, Bodega Bay where that was filmed. I should just, next time I go out to California.
Yes.
Because I'm always right there in the middle of nowhere in the Mojave Desert, so why not?
yeah, why not?
Drive to Isaac Road just for the heck of it.
How would you compare it to Joshua Tree?
I don't know. I've never been to either.
Are they both in California?
Yes.
They just seemed like the same terrain.
It probably is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know enough about that. Maybe some of our listeners can.
U2's album. I like that Joshua Tree album.
I do like U2.
We have a lot to do. We have places to visit, and we have recipes to make.
Yes, we do. Next episode of Real Lit.
And we're doing Like Water for Chocolates.
Como Agua para Chocolata.
Oh, I'm very excited.
That's kind of impressive.
There are recipes throughout the book, so super interesting.
When you watch the film, you're going to get hungry, I can promise.
I'll eat chocolate anytime, anyway.
Absolutely. We're recording that in just a few days.
Yep. So look out for another episode from Real Lit, but also Shelf Criticism.
Shelf Criticism is on hiatus. Season's over. I know I said I was going to do one more, but I get really busy. I mentioned those actors in town. They kept me busy, running around a little bit, taking care of them, and then you get behind having to grade. We keep talking about this, right? Like, they expect us to do our day job, and that's so frustrating. But, yeah, so I know twice now I put off the movie Confidence. It will be back at some point. If everything goes the way that I plan, then really just a few days from now, probably early next week, I'll begin with season two and Shelf Christmasism.
Yay!
By the way, I do not like the holiday of Christmas particularly, so every one on my shelf I did not buy for Christmas films, but yeah, got Elf, The Holiday, Polar Express, Christmas Vacation, which I do like.
Classics.
Classic. And then do we want to go ahead and talk about our December?
Plugging in December. Ahead? We're doing a little bit of a controversial
No, there's no controversy.
Piece.
It is the greatest Christmas movie ever made.
We're doing Die Hard, the
That's
film.
That's right.
And there is some debate on whether it's Christmas or not.
It's Christmas. There's also a novella, 48 Minutes, right? So we'll be reading that novella.
Yep,
talking about that
one.
Adaptation.
That will be fun.
And we'll be back then, huh? We'll confab and see when Parliament After Dark meets again.
Absolutely.
See what we're going to do. There are plenty of good options out there. So we don't have official websites or email addresses or anything for this podcast, but we do for the others.
Yes.
You want to tell them about Real Lit?
So if you have not already liked and joined us, we would love for you to follow us on social media at Real Lit Podcast. That's R-E-E-L, as in a film reel. So that's Real Lit Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, or you can find us on our website, reallitpodcast.com. So just go give us a subscribe when you can.
And email us.
Email us. I love letters. And give us an email at reallit@reallitpodcast.com. We want your letters.
Yeah, the same is true for Shelf Criticism. Shelf Criticism, you can email me at stephen@shelfcriticism. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. Email us about those podcasts or tell us what really horrible midnight movie you want us to cover.
Yeah, give us your take on Zizek Road.
Yeah, I want to hear about that too. Have you actually seen it? Did you love it? Are you buying the 4K tomorrow? Or am I the only weirdo?
I think you're the only weirdo.
I'm a completionist. It's what can I say? Look, there are DVDs on the shelf here too.
I like the commitment.
I'm going to own it.
Well, thank you so much, Reagan.
Happy to join today. Thank you all for having me.
For being here with us.
We're going to have you back.
I hope
Absolutely.
So. I hope you do.
And as a guest on Shelf Criticism, Real Lit, I'm sure at some point as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love that.
Thank you for listening. Parliament is no longer in session.
Killed it.